You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 5th of July, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin, and this is The Big Interview, our programme where people fascinating lives, incredible careers, and great tales to tell sit down and talk to us about how they got here, what really happened, and what makes them tick. With me today is an award-winning novelist and the most widely read woman writer in Turkey. She's published 13 books, 9 of which are novels. She writes fiction in both Turkish and English, and she blends Western and Eastern traditions of storytelling, bringing out the myriad stories of women, minorities, immigrants, subcultures, youth, and global souls. Her books have been published in more than 40 countries, and she was awarded the honorary distinction of Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters. She is Elif Shafak. Critics have named her as one of the most distinctive voices in contemporary Turkish and world literature. Shafak's writing breaks down categories, clichés and cultural ghettos. She's also an active political commentator, columnist and public speaker, and this is her big interview. Elif Shafak, welcome to The Big Interview.
Thank you.
And now, you were born in Strasbourg. You moved around a great deal as a child, and yours wasn't at all a typical patriarchal family. So can you tell me about your early years as the daughter of a diplomat and a philosopher?
I was born in Strasbourg in France, and my parents got separated shortly afterwards. So I came back to Ankara, Turkey, with my mom, and thereafter I was raised by a single mother, a divorcee, which at the time was a bit unusual. This was a very conservative Muslim neighborhood. And because my mother had dropped out of university because she thought law was enough, by the time she came back, she had no diploma, no job, and no money. So usually women in such positions are immediately married off to someone else, and usually to someone older, because they're not very favorable in the marital market anymore. It was my grandmother who interfered, and she said, no, I'll take care of my granddaughter. You go back to college, graduate, have your own job, have your own career. And so I grew up observing a solidarity, a sisterhood between these two very different women, and I think that left an impact on me.
Mm. Obviously, huge influences on your life, both your mother and your grandmother. And in fact, your pen name reflects your mother's name.
That is true. My mother's first name, I mean, not her surname. I kind of wanted to turn it upside down, maybe rather than having a paternal connection, I wanted to have a maternal connection. And instead of using my father's surname, I wanted to use my mother's name. But also because I like the word. It means dawn, like the beginning. So I like the meaning as well, I guess.
Well, let's talk about the beginning. Have you always written?
I have, in a way, you know, when I look back, I can see that it goes all the way back to my childhood. I started writing at the age 8, but that was not because I wanted to become a novelist or anything like that. I didn't know there was such a choice, such an option. I was a very lonely child. You know, I didn't have siblings. I didn't grow up in an extended family. And in a way, I was an observer. I always felt as an other, as an outsider, insider. And the introvert in me felt maybe a bit aloof from the society, from the culture I was surrounded with. So books became where my very good friends, and they still are. That's how everything began. You know, I started writing diaries, like I was keeping a journal, but because I thought my life was incredibly boring, I had nothing to write in it. So I started making up things. You know, I started writing about people who didn't really exist, things that didn't really happen. So for me, it was a very easy step to cross that boundary between fiction and nonfiction, what is reality and what is imaginary.
Going back to feeling like an outsider, I guess some of that was down to the fact that you moved around all over the world. You were in Amman, you were in Madrid, Turkey, as we know, born in France. But you're known as a Turkish writer. So I'm wondering where you're from. I mean, you've written very powerfully about identity politics.
I do question identity politics all the time. Obviously, I am a Turkish writer, and I feel very attached to lots of things in Turkey, about Turkey, especially Istanbul. The city herself has a very special place in my heart. But at the same time, I think we can have multiple belongings. You know, we do not need to choose one identity at the expense of others. So there's a part of me that that's Mediterranean, that's connected to the Balkans, that understands the Middle East, but at the same time, I feel European. Most importantly, I think I'm a world citizen, maybe if I may say, a global soul. I like that word.
Mm. Your second book brought together Jewish and Islamic mysticism, and I just wonder where your own religious or spiritual leanings lie.
I am very interested in spirituality, but I find this a little bit difficult to talk about, especially in Turkey, where the culture is incredibly polarized. If you are interested in faith, people automatically think you are religious. I am not a religious person at all. And I have an issue with organized religions, the way they divide humanity between us and them is not close to my heart. What I am interested in is individual journeys of faith and doubt, because I think human beings need both. Mm. You can't only have absolute faith, then you can't progress. We need to have doubt as well, you know, to question things. So I'm interested in agnosticism, mysticism, Sufism. And once you delve into that ocean, you can't stop anywhere. You know, there are no boundaries. So if you're reading about Islamic mysticism, you might just as well start reading about Jewish mysticism or Christian mysticism, mostly because these people were incredibly close to each other.
I'd like to talk about The Bastard of Istanbul. Now, that was written in English and it was longlisted for the Orange Prize, and it dealt with the Armenian genocide. Recently, of course, we've heard the Pope coming out and actually recognising that that happened, which is a great thing. But that book was responsible for getting you into a great deal of trouble. Tell me about that experience.
Yes, I did get into trouble after the book was published. I was sued, prosecuted for insulting Turkishness under Article 301 of the Turkish Constitution. And it was a very, very surreal, unnerving experience, if I may say. On the one hand, I don't want to paint a very black picture, because I had an amazingly positive, heartwarming and moving response from the readers, particularly from women readers. But at the same time, I was sued, and there were some, you know, protests on the streets by ultranationalists spitting at my pictures, burning my pictures. And that went on for a year. The weird thing is my lawyer had to defend Armenian fictional characters in the courtroom, because the words of the fictional characters were used as evidence during the trial. So everything was very, very weird. And it was for the first time a work of fiction was being put on trial in this way.
The book obviously had such resonance in Turkey and it caused this enormous reaction. Why write it in English then?
I have been writing in English for the last 12, 13 years now. That wasn't the first book I wrote in English. The thing is, my earlier novels all were written in Turkish first, and after a certain point, I started writing in English first. What happens is each book I write in English, it's being translated into Turkish, and I take the Turkish translation and I kind of rewrite it with my own pace and rhythm. I keep doing this. It's a bit insane and a lot of work, but I do it because I love language. Or languages, you know, I love the commute back and forth. And to be honest, sometimes I think when you think, write, dream in another language, you earn an additional zone of freedom. And I need that space. Sometimes, you know, writing in English helps me to put a distance between myself and the land where I come from. And somehow that distance helps me to look more closely at Turkey or my motherland. So we need a little bit of distance, intellectual, cognitive distance sometimes, to see things better.
Your latest book is called The Architect's Apprentice. Tell me about that.
I wrote about 16th century Ottoman Empire, focusing on the life of Sinan, who was regarded as the greatest architect in the Islamic world. But not many people know that Sinan was born a Christian. He was most probably Armenian or Greek and remained a Christian until the age 21. Interestingly, because he was so bright, when he became the chief royal architect, he was asked by the Sultan to make bigger domes for Islam and surpass the dome of Hagia Sophia, the dome of Christianity. But when you look at Sinan's words, he always saw the dome not as an instrument of hostility or war or competition, but as an all-embracing, unifying concept. So he says that we all live under the same invisible dome, and under that dome there's equal space for Jews, Muslims, Zoroastrians and Christians. I have been very drawn to his personality, work ethics, and I wanted to tell the story through the eyes of his apprentice by mostly concentrating on the lives and stories of people who have been forgotten in Turkish official historiography. So I wrote extensively in this book about minorities, including sexual minorities in the Ottoman Empire.
And that book was written originally in English?
Yes, it was written in English, translated into Turkish, and then again reshaped by me afterwards.
You've written that language, particularly in Turkey, is polarized and politicized. What do you mean by that?
Oh, it is an extremely polarized society, more so than, now than ever. And I find that incredibly unhealthy. I think there's a lot of anger in Turkey and resentment. You know, people are just angry at each other.
How's that reflected in the language? You talk about old and new language.
Yes. For a long time, the conservatives have been more appreciative of old words, whereas the modernists have focused on new words. And I find this duality very, very artificial. I don't want to belong anywhere in this dilemma because I want to use both old and new words. And that's one of the things that fascinates me about the English language. You know, we in Turkey, we have Turkified our language and we have taken out a significant portion of our vocabulary. And by doing that, we have lost nuances because those words used to come from Arabic or Persian origin, and now they're gone. Whereas I listen to people speaking English, they say chutzpah, they say kismet, and nobody says, oh, this word comes from a Jewish origin or an Arabic origin. Mm. You know, the English language has a welcoming attitude to all words of all ages and all ethnic backgrounds. And I think that's the way it should be. But that said, I do feel very attached to the Turkish language. I love it dearly, but I am critical of the way in which its vocabulary has diminished.
Mm. You talk about that essential space that writing in English gives you from your homeland. Do you think that you write differently in English or Turkish? And do they have a different rhythm to them?
I think I do write differently. I observe people, I think, you know, even when we speak another language, our voices change, the intonation, even our body language changes. And that's mostly because languages shape us. Each language has its own rhythm, has its own labyrinth. I love observing, you know. I wish I could do it in more than two languages. So it's the commute that appeals to me. But that said, maybe I should tell you that if I'm writing about sorrow, melancholy, if there's sadness, I find it easier to express that in Turkish. And when it comes to humor, irony, satire particularly, I find it much, much easier in English.
That's extraordinary. What about music? Do you write to music, and does the music that you write to change depending on what your subject is and indeed what language you're writing in?
Music is incredibly important to me. Because I'm usually in my daily life, I have a calmer energy. People assume that I listen to calm music when I'm writing fiction, but it is the exact opposite. First of all, I can't write in silence. There has to be sounds, lots and lots of sounds. Maybe it's because I got used to this in Istanbul. You know, Istanbul is a very noisy city, but I like that. The sounds of the streets, of the city breathing. And at the same time, there has to be loud music. I usually listen to, you know, industrial, gothic, metal over and over, you know, on repeat.
It really is quite extraordinary, particularly when you look at you. You are such a beautiful, elegant, calm woman. I just can't imagine you listening to that kind of thing. But in fact, you actually write lyrics for Turkish pop songs.
Yeah, I have worked with mostly rock singers. I like lyrics. You know, I can't see myself writing poetry. I wish I could. It's a different talent. But lyrics, yeah, I'm very interested in.
Let's talk about your autobiography. In Black Milk, you confronted your own postnatal depression and also the challenges of being both a writer and a mother. Is that an uneasy pairing?
I have experienced a postpartum depression after the birth of my daughter. And I wrote about this in a book titled Black Milk. It was very unusual because in Turkey, motherhood is over-romanticized. You know, you're expected to jump, you know, in the air with joy. Certainly, it is a huge blessing. But at the same time, you might experience some difficulties, you know, ups and downs. And I think it's quite normal. We should be able to talk about these things. I realized at the time I could not stop crying. And my grandma, she said to me, you shouldn't cry because if you cry, your milk will turn sour. Visually, I thought about that. Maybe I can't stop crying, but if with that sour milk, I can turn it into ink. And with an ink, I can write a book. And maybe the book will help me to understand myself, which is exactly what happened. Black Milk deals with creativity, depression, having multiple selves. So it's not only about motherhood. I think we all have conflicting selves inside us. But most importantly, it has humor in it. You know, the moment we can laugh at our follies, at our weaknesses, things become lighter. I realized in that book that I had a monarchy inside me without democracy. We always think about democracy as an external thing, but there should also be an internal democracy. So in the book, I write about how these different elites quarrel. They topple down the monarch in a way. There's coup d'etat, there's anarchy, but eventually an inner democracy in which I learned to accept and embrace each and every different self that I carry inside.
And do you have a different self for every book? Is your head in a different place every time you write another novel?
I think so. You know, when we start a book, we are a different person. By the time we finish it, I think we are different because stories change us. They do not only affect the reader, but also the writer herself. And particularly the novel is an interesting genre because you have to live with these characters for weeks, months, sometimes years, and they become your friends, they become your reality. So definitely it is a transformative experience. Mm.
Earlier on, you were talking about Istanbul and you referred to her as she, the she city. Who is she? She's almost another character in your books.
Istanbul for me is definitely a vibrant, active, you know, character full of energy. She's throbbing. Yeah, I mean, the city itself is throbbing with energy. It is not a passive city at all. And when you look at Ottoman literature, Istanbul has always been depicted as a woman. And I find that very, very true. However, in Istanbul, just like in many other places in the Middle East, unfortunately, today streets belong to men, squares belong to men, you know, cities belong to men. Women are more and more pushed to the private space. I'm reminded that our primary role is motherhood and being a wife. I find it very important that there be more and more women of all backgrounds in the public space. Mm. We need to get our streets back.
And you've written that men write, women read, and that you'd like to change that. And of course, feminism has been a huge part of your life. Are you beginning to see Turkey swinging behind that?
I find gender issues very, very important. And I maybe, you know, I don't know what to call it, feminist or post-feminist. I have huge respect for women's movement and the struggles of generations of women. At the same time, I would like to carry it forward. I think feminism had its own blind spots, particularly about LGBT issues, maybe race, class. You know, it had its own blind spots as well, which we need to improve. So I believe in it and I want to carry forward. In Turkey, unfortunately, we have had lots of problems. An increase in domestic violence, huge increase in gender violence, even gender homicides. And over, conservative politicians telling us from above how we as Turkish women should dress up, how many children we should have, three, preferably five, you know, whether we can have C-section, talking about abortion, saying that Turkish women should not laugh out loud in the public space because it's not proper, saying that we should focus on our, you know, motherhood as our primary work. All these things, one after another, I find it very, very dangerous. I think women in Turkey became, in an interesting way, more politicized and are becoming more politicized because we are realizing we have more to lose.
Obviously, you've been enormously active in defending not only women's rights, but freedom of expression and also democracy. Do you think it's a writer's role to be political?
I do not think that if you're a writer, primarily from countries like Turkey, Pakistan, Egypt, Nigeria, you know, countries where democracy is still an unfulfilled dream, we do not have the luxury of being apolitical. Anything and everything we write about has political connotations. You know, in Turkey, politics is incredibly heavy. And also coming from women's movement, I do know that politics is not only about political parties or the parliament. In our daily life as well, there is politics in our bedrooms, in our kitchens as well. Mm. So I don't think I have that kind of luxury. And when I do events, I get questions about literature, but I receive so many political questions as well, which I have to think about. Also, my background is in political science, political philosophy, so I'm not aloof to this area. However, there's a nuance for me. My primary guide is always the art of storytelling, is imagination. There can be political questions in my work, but I do not like it when writers try to teach something or write with a mission. I do not like it when writers think they're better than their readers. You know, that's not my attitude. I just appreciate asking questions, particularly about taboos, silences, and it is up to the reader to find their own answer, but the questions must be asked. Mm.
Do you feel under pressure to be a spokesperson for Turkey? And do you think that the country's finally now finding its own voice?
I can only represent myself. You know, I do know that the Islamic world is a very colourful tapestry of so many voices. Turkey in particular is incredibly complicated, you know. So how can one person represent anything bigger than herself or himself? I don't believe in that. However, as I said, I am interested in so many things that are happening in Turkey, and I like to think about these questions together, you know, to have a dialogue. I think dialogues are important. So I'm interested in stories, but also silences. The recent elections was, of course, very, very important, and many people feel more hope, a huge sense of relief. But we must understand that in Turkey, we do have, in a way, the shape of democracy. We do have the ballot box and everything, which is very important. I'm not belittling it. But the culture of democracy is also very important. And by the culture of democracy, I mean respect for the other, you know, pluralism, coexistence. People sometimes confuse democracy with majoritarianism. They think if you have the majority in the ballot box, you can do everything you want. And that's a huge mistake.
You've also written very interestingly about that whole divide, the thing that people always point out about Turkey, that it's on the very crux, that it's East meets West.
Yes, I mean, it's a land of contradictions and this conflict. Istanbul itself, again, sometimes people think, because Istanbul has, you know, when you cross the bridge, it says, welcome to the European continent. You cross it in the other direction, it says, welcome to the Asian continent. Sometimes I feel like we are that bridge itself, maybe not exactly welcome anywhere, you know, dangling in the air. And identity is a big, big issue in Turkey. And that's why the questions that Turkish novelists ask are very relevant for this age. Mm.
Being European, though, is important to you, I know. You were a founder member of the European Council on Foreign Relations. Tell me about that.
I have supported and I do support Turkey's EU membership, even though I'm very well aware that at the moment it's, you know, the chances are very, very slim. But nonetheless, it makes me very sad because once there was a historic moment, not that long ago, when it seemed almost possible that Turkey could become an EU member, there was a lot of support, especially in Turkey, you know, more than 82% public support. And today it's below 20%. The mood has changed. People have changed. And since then, Turkey has moved in the opposite direction. I do not want my country to be closer to Russia or Pakistan. I want it to be part of Europe and share the same ideals with regards to liberal democracy and human rights and gender rights and freedom of expression. So I'm critical of the Turkish government for not fulfilling the EU criteria, but I am equally critical of several populist politicians in Europe, particularly continental Europe, who have used Turkey as the other. They were incredibly short-sighted, you know. They do not understand that it's better to have Turkey closer to Europe than away from it.
Mm. How optimistic do you feel for the future of Turkey?
I mean, I'm always half optimistic, half pessimistic. You know, when I look at the regime, the system, the political structure, especially the dominance of the state, because Turkey comes from a strong state tradition, just like Russia. So in a normal democracy, you would protect the individual from the excessive power of the state. In Turkey, it's the opposite. Even though the state is strong, you always protect the state from the words of individuals and sue the individuals. Mm. So these are incredibly problematic. There's change, but very slow moving. All of that makes me pessimistic. But when I look at the people, then I feel much more optimistic, especially youth, minorities, ethnic, sexual, cultural minorities, women in particular, amazingly vocal and visible in many areas. So these things always, you know, give us more hope. I think it's better to focus on the people because especially in the Middle East, the people are always ahead of their governments.
And your own future, what's coming up for you?
I'm a storyteller. That's what I love doing. You know, this is my passion. I also love giving talks, you know, never seen it as a burden, festivals, book readings, but basically I'm an introvert. So my primary instinct is always, you know, to look for the next story and, you know, just keep doing the art of storytelling that I love so dearly.
Have you got one particular story in mind?
Each time I start writing a novel, I do a lot of research. Maybe that's the academic in me, you know, that I carry with me that kind of discipline, even though I'm not a disciplined person at all in my daily life, especially if it's a historical novel, but also for contemporary. I read everything, anything, you know, I can find on the subject, taking notes. And only after a certain stage, I stop reading and start to fly, start to imagine. But first, I have to research well and understand the subject. I love to weave, if I may, you know, reality and imagination, you know, real questions with creativity.
So you're reading, obviously, while you're writing for research purposes. But can you read fiction if you're writing fiction?
I do. I do. I mean, I read a lot of fiction and nonfiction. I think as writers, we must first and foremost be good readers and remain good readers. But I do not believe that a novelist primarily benefits from reading novels. Anything can inspire us, you know, some music, you know, an exhibition, a movie. We should be open to, you know, that kind of connectivity. I have an interdisciplinary background and I love learning from different disciplines and working within different disciplines. So I'm, you know, I do read fiction, not only Turkish or English, but also from very different lands, and also translated fiction I do read. But at the same time, I read, you know, on Sufism, I read nonfiction. I love reading on political philosophy, especially Walter Benjamin, the Frankfurt School, you know, many of the questions that were discussed back in those days, I still find them very relevant.
Let's talk about your day-to-day life, your writing routine, and the fact that you seem to be based in so many different places.
Well, I'm based in London now. You know, I think there are two different ways of writing novels, in my opinion. For some writers, you have a discipline every day, let's say from 9 to 2 o'clock, every day, you know, same pace, same rhythm. I am not like that. For me, I can write during day or night. I have a pendulum. When I am writing a novel, I'm inside the novel and that becomes the priority. But when I have finished a novel, the pendulum swings in the opposite direction. I become a more social, normal person. And I become interested in other things. I learn and then I go back into the novel. And also, I think there's a gender difference. You know, for male writers, in my opinion, it's slightly easier to have the same rhythm day in, day out. But many women writers have had to multitask all throughout their lives. And that's maybe the case with me.
You've written about your fascination with typewriters. You don't write in longhand at all.
That's mostly because I was left-handed as a child, and at the time at school, we were forced to become right-handed. And I never liked my handwriting. I get bored very easily. I still can't hold a pencil very comfortably, you know, so for me, longhand is impossible. And I much prefer writing using a keyboard. Then I feel like I can connect with both hands, left and right.
I love the idea that one of the most distinctive voices of her generation can't actually hold a pen.
No, still not.
If you had one piece of advice to give to budding writers, or indeed people who just feel very strongly about their countries and want to speak out in defence of them and perhaps write on those subjects, what would that be?
Well, I think in everything we do, the thing that makes a big difference is whether we love it or not. And I'm not saying like, I'm saying love. There has to be love. You know, whether we open a pastry shop or write a book or, you know, make a movie, but love makes a big difference. That kind of faith that comes with love. Then we stop thinking about what other people are going to say. If I may add this, you know, I go to lots of different schools in Turkey and abroad, and I observe young girls, young children who have so much courage, so much creativity, you know, they want to do so many things. And then you go to different schools, high school students, and something has happened to those students. They don't speak up anymore. Particularly girls take a step back. They lose their confidence, chutzpah. And that makes me very, very sad. So the social conditioning, I think we are really killing the creativity in young minds. And if I may give just a little bit of advice, I would say we need to stick to our creativity.
Elif Shafak, thank you very much
indeed.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Georgina Godwin, talking to the writer Elif Shafak. Tune in next week to hear Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound meet the graphic designer Milton Glaser. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.